Laudator Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
The Holy Father will be heading to Germany next week. But who was Saint Boniface, the Apostle of Germany? We will hear more from Joan Lewis. Secondly, have you washed your hands today? More importantly, did you wash them before you ate? The Pharisees in today's Gospel had serious problems because Jesus and his disciples ate with dirty hands. Listen to what Jill Bevilacqua and Sean Patrick Lovett have to say about the reading for this Sunday.
The Pharisees and some of the experts in the law who had come from Jerusalem gathered around Jesus. They had observed a few of his disciples eating meals without having purified, that is to say, washed, their hands. The Pharisees, and in fact all Jews, cling to the custom of their ancestors and never eat without scrupulously washing their hands. Moreover, they never eat anything from the market without first sprinkling it. There are many other traditions they observe. For example, the washing of cups and jugs and kettles. So the Pharisees and the scribes questioned him. Why do your disciples not follow the tradition of our ancestors, but instead take food without purifying their hands? He said to them, How accurately Isaiah prophesied about you hypocrites when he wrote, This people pays me lip service, but their heart is far from me. Empty is the reverence they do me, because they teach as dogmas mere human precepts. You disregard God's commandment and cling to what is human tradition. He summoned the crowd again and said to them, Hear me, all of you, and try to understand. Nothing that enters a man from outside can make him impure. That which comes out of him, and only that, constitutes impurity. Let everyone heed what he hears. Wicked designs come from the deep recesses of the heart. Acts of fornication, theft, murder, adulterous conduct, greed, maliciousness, deceit, sensuality, envy, blasphemy, arrogance, and obtuse spirit. All these evils come from within and render a man impure.
After the parenthesis of the last few weeks, when John's Gospel brought us our Lord's great discourse on the bread of life, we return today to the Gospel of Mark, on a celebrated occasion when Jesus made an important distinction between outward behaviour and inward attitudes. The Pharisees have come from Jerusalem with some of the scribes, the experts in the law, as we heard. Jesus had been in Jerusalem recently, probably for the feast of Passover, and now he was back in Galilee, probably in Capernaum, which was his base. And these men had followed him, not because they wanted to become disciples, but in order to watch him and his followers, in the hope of catching him out in what he taught or did. They're not long in finding something to criticize.
Why do your disciples not follow the tradition of our ancestors, but instead take food without purifying their hands?
What might to us seem merely a reference to a lack of hygiene was a far more serious accusation of disrespect for an age-old custom, a disregard for that ritual cleanliness which had become an essential part of Jewish life and to which the Pharisees paid an exaggerated honour. Mark, who was writing for non-Jews, the Romans in particular, goes into some detail in his explanation. They cling to the custom of their ancestors, we heard, and never eat without scrupulously washing their hands. Washing their arms as far as the elbow, runs another version. Next comes the market. Now, not to eat anything from the market without first sprinkling it sounds reasonable enough. We all wash fruit, salad and other vegetables, though we might look askance at someone who insisted on doing the same to dry foods. But in other versions, the picture's a little different. On returning from the marketplace, they never eat without first sprinkling themselves, we read in the Jerusalem Bible. And the Revised Standard Version has, when they come from the marketplace, they do not eat unless they purify themselves. The Vulgate has simply, when they come from the market, unless they be washed, they eat not. The particular complaint the Pharisees make has to do with eating, with food. But if we look at the definition of the Pharisee, separated or set apart, it's hardly surprising that they would feel contaminated every time they went to the market. As one scholar comments, they thought that the market might pollute them. As for the washing of cups and pots and bronze dishes, there was apparently a whole chapter of the Talmud dedicated to that. There were phrases like these. If someone eats bread, and this of course could mean any food, without washing his hands, it's as if he were going with a prostitute. And again, he who despises the washing of hands will be removed from this world. Ominous. And supposing there was no water in the immediate vicinity, what then? One must go and look for it, travelling anything up to 4 miles. So the Pharisee teachers prescribed. Knowing all this as he did, Jesus wastes no time in defending the conduct of his disciples, but goes straight to the heart of the matter. Well did Isaiah prophesy of you hypocrites, and he quotes the prophet's complaint. Speaking in the name of God, Isaiah had declared,
"This people honours me only with lip service, while their hearts are far from me. The worship they offer me is worthless. The doctrines they teach are only human regulations."
And Jesus concluded,
"You put aside the commandment of God to cling to human traditions."
In Matthew's account of the same episode, he quotes the disciples as saying to Jesus in private, "Do you know that the Pharisees were shocked when they heard what you said?" But our Lord, who naturally knew very well how the Pharisees felt, told his disciples,
"Leave them alone. They are blind men leading blind men. And if one blind man leads another, both will fall into a pit."
It could easily be concluded from this exchange with the Pharisees that Jesus had no respect for tradition or commonly accepted codes of behaviour. But we find him in the Gospels reminding a Pharisee who had invited him to dinner that he had neglected to perform what was a common gesture of courtesy to a guest. A scholar reminds us,
"An important Hebrew custom was the washing of the guest's feet, a gesture of welcome in a hot, dusty country where stony roads often made foot travel a painful experience."
Back in the Old Testament, in fact, there was the famous occasion when Abraham was sitting at the door of his tent in the heat of the day, when, behold, 3 men stood in front of him. And what does he do? He offers them water to drink and to wash the dust from their feet. And the visitors, as we know, turned out to be angels. When Jesus was at table in the house of Simon the Pharisee, a woman known as a sinner came in with an alabaster flask of ointment, and recounts Luke,
"Standing behind him at his feet, weeping, she began to wet his feet with her tears, and wiped them with the hair of her head, and kissed his feet, and anointed them with the ointment."
And Jesus reproaches Simon, who is more concerned to judge his guest for letting himself be touched by a public sinner.
"Do you see this woman? I entered your house, you gave me no water for my feet, but she has wet my feet with her tears, and wiped them with her hair. You gave me no kiss, but from the time I came in, she has not ceased to kiss my feet. You did not anoint my head with oil, but she has anointed my feet with ointment."
Apart from the customs of washing after contact with the unclean or before touching food, there was also the opposite, as recounted by Sir James Fraser, the Scottish anthropologist, in The Golden Bough.
"It is a common belief that the effect of contact with a sacred object must be removed, by washing or otherwise, before a man is free to mingle with his fellows. Thus the Jews wash their hands after reading the sacred scriptures. Before coming forth from the tabernacle after the sin offering, the high priest had to wash himself and put off the garments which he had worn in the holy place."
Certainly the whole idea of using water to purify the person, whether in the ordinary act of washing to cleanse the body of dirt or in a symbolic act of spiritual purification, runs through all cultures and all religions. Nor has literature resisted the temptation to use such an act to dramatic effect, as in the sleepwalking scene of Shakespeare's Macbeth, when the guilty queen tries in vain to wash the blood from the hand that has committed murder. A waiting woman takes a doctor to observe Lady Macbeth sleepwalking. And the doctor observes how she rubs her hands. The woman answers, it's an accustomed action with her to seem thus washing her hands. I've known her to continue in this for a quarter of an hour.
Yet here's a spot. Out, damned spot, out, I say. Yet who would have thought the old man to have had so much blood in him? What? Will these hands ne'er be clean? Here's the smell of the blood still. All the perfumes of Arabia will not sweeten this little hand. Oh!
Far removed from the imagination of the dramatist, in the real-life drama of the Passion, there's another scene of ritual hand-washing.
So when Pilate saw that he was gaining nothing, but rather that a riot was beginning, he took water and washed his hands before the crowd, saying, I am innocent of this righteous man's blood. See to it yourselves.
Writes a scholar.
Pilate abjures his responsibility with a typically Oriental symbolic gesture. In reality, his blame is not entirely taken away thus.
Probably no symbolic act of hand-washing is more celebrated than this. There are, of course, genuine acts of this kind, one of which still exists in the church's liturgy. It takes place at the offertory and is one of the quieter, though no less significant, moments of the Mass. After he has offered the water and wine, the priest goes to the side of the altar and washes his hands, saying to himself, Lord, wash away my iniquity, cleanse me from my sin. The ceremony originated, we're told, in the practical necessity of cleansing the fingers after handling loaves of bread, but came to signify that purity with which the sacred mysteries should be approached. When there's a server, he pours the water over the celebrant's fingers and catches it in a bowl. Until the Second Vatican Council, the priest recited part of a psalm while washing the extremities of his fingers. Known as the lavabo, from the first words he spoke, the ceremony was explained, runs a note in the old Roman Missal, by the mystical reason that one can never be pure enough to touch the God of all purity. The psalm is described as the prayer of a man of integrity, or prayer of the blameless.
I will wash my hands among the innocent, and will compass thine altar, O Lord, that I may hear the voice of praise, and tell of all thy wondrous works. I have loved, O Lord, the beauty of thy house, and the place where dwelleth thy glory. Take not away my soul, O God, with the wicked, nor my life with men of blood, in whose hands are iniquities, their right hand is filled with gifts. But I have walked in my innocence. Redeem me, and have mercy on me. My foot hath stood in the direct way, in the churches. I will bless thee, O Lord.
In a comment on the psalm, a scholar writes,
the text joins this declaration of innocence to an entrance liturgy to the temple, reminding us that the prayer is said by the priest before the great prayer of the Eucharistic canon.
Modern translations make this clear, as in this one.
To prove my innocence, I wash my hands and take my place around your altar.
Or in this.
I wash my hands in innocence and join the procession round your altar.
When our Lord accused the Pharisees of lip service, did he have this psalm in mind? The verse preceding that which opens the lavabo is revealing.
I never take my place with liars, and with hypocrites I shall not go. I hate the evildoers' company. I will not take my place with the wicked.
I refuse to sit down with the wicked, runs another version. It does smack strangely of the Pharisees' attitude and their disapproval of Jesus for sitting down with sinners. In the last part of today's Gospel, Jesus calls the crowd to him and urges them to try to understand that only what comes out of a man can make him impure. But how much the crowd understood is doubtful, as even his followers questioned him, writes Mark, when he had gone back into the house, away from the crowd. Perhaps today we think we have understood. But can we claim honestly to be better than the Pharisees? As a modern scholar comments,
the same faults could be urged against ourselves. Catholics from the highest to the lowest have been guilty of them. St. John Chrysostom was not the first or the last to say, "We imitate the hypocrites, we have even surpassed them."
Perhaps we would do well to remember what St. Paul wrote to the Corinthians. "Let anyone who thinks that he stands take heed lest he fall."
And now Joan Lewis and I talk about a still quiet week in the Vatican.
Joan Knows. Conversations with Joan Lewis.
Joan, welcome back after the holidays.
It's been quite a while since we have sat together in this studio to do the weekly show, but you had your vacation and then I had mine. We did some shows before, we prepared some shows before we left, and here we are live, folks. Normally what we do is highlight some of the week's events in the Vatican, because normally there are so many different events to choose from, but this week we could just sit here and do the whole show about the only events really that took place, beginning on Sunday, I think, with the Angelus at Castel Gandolfo, which, if any of our listeners have ever been there, they'll know what a wonderful, intimate thing it is. The very small courtyard at the palace, the very beautiful palace, the piazza in front of it in the town of Castel Gandolfo, overlooking the lake, which is in a extinct volcano. Anyway, it's a very wonderful experience. And it's summertime. People go in a much more relaxed, less frenetic mood. But the Pope at that Angelus reflected on the lives of St. Monica and her son, St. Augustine, because, of course, that day, that Sunday and then Monday, were their respective feast days, Sunday Monica, Monday St. Augustine. And the Pope said the two are examples of prayer in the face of difficulties and also as a sign of hope. And I can remember, if I can just interject something here, I can remember my mother, when she would get a little peeved at my brothers, who were perhaps a little more rambunctious than my sister and I were as youngsters. My mother always referred to St. Monica. She talked about St. Monica being the mother of Augustine, and he gave his mother so many problems with his terrible temperament. And she just prayed and prayed and prayed and prayed. And of course, guess what? He was converted. Yeah, he became a priest. He became a bishop. He's one of the most incredible writers. As the Pope said in a reference to her prayers and her difficult son, St. Monica's life can console mothers today who are anguished because their children choose mistaken ways. A very wonderful line.
And can I also just interject? Because any visitors to Rome who have the opportunity to visit Ostia Antica, in wandering around those beautiful ruins, will also find a special plaque there to Monica, because she, of course, lived and died there. And also, part of her gravestone is inside the tiny museum in the Porta San Paolo in the middle of Rome.
Oh, I knew the first part but about Ostia because I'd seen it, but I did not know the second part. So something to add to a tourist agenda or the agenda of someone even who lives here.
Yes, and it has both Monica's name and also Augustine's name on that slab.
You know, interestingly enough, I learned this summer a priest friend from Santa Susanna's church here in Rome was transferred to the United States. He'll be in Austin, Texas. And in doing some research on Austin, he discovered that that is a diminutive of the name Augustine.
Oh, didn't you know that?
I did not know that Austin was.
Which is why in England, centuries and centuries old tradition, is that the Augustinians are also known as the Austin Friars.
Austin, Augustine referred to a very wonderful man whose conversion was really, really complete. Talk about a turnaround from his, and as the Pope said, Augustine made his mother suffer with his rebellious temperament. However, of course, after his rebellious youth and conversion, which, by the way, took place in Milan under the Bishop St. Ambrose, Augustine opened up to, as Pope Benedict said, to the fullness of truth and love, and he eventually became the Bishop of Hippo. So that was Sunday, and then Monday, back at, still, if you will, at Castel Gandolfo, the Holy Father met with the German Chancellor, Angela Merkel. It was a very interesting meeting, scheduled to last about 30 minutes, lasted 40. They discussed, according to Merkel, who spoke to the press afterwards, this is her second meeting with him. She did meet him, though not as Chancellor, in August of 2005 for World Youth Day, and she will meet him in just over a week's time, when the Pope goes to his homeland for a six-day visit. But she told reporters that she and the Pope, and it was interesting the word she used, they spoke intensely, she said, about world politics, especially the situation in the Middle East, and also about what the international community is doing with Iran. And then she defined the meeting, of course, as very cordial. She said the two of them also talked about religious freedom and Europe's identity, which the chancellor said she stressed to the Pope that this identity was formed by Christianity. And of course, as we know, the chancellor, and we know from past years, the Holy See has insisted on including a reference to Europe's Christian roots in the European Union Constitution. And then, by the way, speaking of the European Union, Germany will assume the rotating presidency of the EU next year. Now, I learned something interesting in a little bit of research about the chancellor for this visit. First of all, in her country, there are about 35% of Germans are Catholic. And Merkel, she's a trained physicist. I did not know that. And the daughter of a Protestant pastor, and she was raised in former communist East Germany. So she and the Pope apparently have, how can we say it, hit it off, not just this time, but also last August. And she described the Pope as a thoughtful theologian with a clear stance in a secular world. And she said she was really delighted to be able to visit the Pope at this time. I think another highlight, just going to the news of this week, the little that was made public, on Tuesday, the announcement on Tuesday that Archbishop Angelo Bagnasco, who was the military ordinary for Italy, has been named the new Archbishop of Genoa. Of course, several months ago, that's June, the then Archbishop, Cardinal Tarcisio Bertone, was named as the new Vatican Secretary of State. So he will take that position in the Vatican on September 15th. And he's replacing retiring Cardinal Angelo Sodano. So the Genovese are getting another Genovese as their archbishop because he's from the area, knows the church well on the Ligurian Riviera. Traditionally, that does bring a cardinal's red hat with it. So we shall be following that kind of event in coming months.
And now with the Holy Father going to Germany next week. Who was St. Boniface?
I'm glad that was brought up because he's really a very interesting man and a very interesting saint. He was the apostle of Germany, born in, the year isn't exactly known, about between 673 and 680. And he was a missionary to Germany from 719. He was born, by the way, and educated at a Benedictine monastery in Exeter, England, and became a Benedictine monk there. What he was known for at his time, during his time in Germany, was the fact that he destroyed many idols and many pagan temples and built churches on those sites, Catholic churches on those sites. He reformed churches in his diocese when he was the Bishop of Mainz and then the Archbishop of Mainz. And he built many religious houses as well. He also went to Holland where he did some evangelizing. But however, it was there where he was set upon by a troop of pagans and he and 52 members of his flock were martyred. in Holland. But it's very, very interesting because of his efforts at evangelizing, at destroying pagan idols and temples and rebuilding churches on that. There's a couple of fun stories associated with him. One is in Saxony, he encountered a tribe worshiping a Norse deity in the form of a huge oak tree. And Boniface walked up to the tree, removed his shirt, took up an axe, and without a word, he hacked down the absolute entire tree. And so he's now standing on the 6-foot-wide little bit of a trunk that is left. And he stood on it and he said, "How stands your mighty God? My God is stronger than he." Now, as the person who wrote the story said, the crowd's reaction was mixed, but some conversions were begun. I can kind of see both sides of that. And then there's another tradition about St. Boniface, which says he used the customs of the locals to help convert them. In fact, there was a game in which they, this is without specifying which locals, in which they threw sticks called kegels at smaller sticks called heidis. And Boniface brought religion into the game, and calling the heidis, saying they represent demons, and knocking them down with the others, which showed purity of spirit. Anyway, he's the patron of brewers, I do not know why, of file cutters, and of several dioceses in Germany, and also of Manitoba, interestingly enough. And he is listed as being the patron of World Youth Day. In kind of getting some information on Boniface, I found a letter that Pope Gregory II wrote to Boniface on November 22nd, 726, answering some questions that Boniface had put to him about the faith and the teaching of the Holy Roman and Apostolic Church. And this is in a missive that was brought by a messenger to Rome. And the Pope answered an absolutely fascinating reading, 726. The questions regarded to what degrees can marriages be solemnized where people believe that they might be related. What would be the degree of consanguinity? What will a man do if his wife is unable through illness to allow him his marital rights? What does one do in the sacred mass? Can one put 2 or 3 chalices on the altar? Because our Lord at the Last Supper, of course, only used one. As to foods offered in sacrifice to idols, may a believer eat them, and so forth. Most of those are not questions for us today, but some can be. If a mother, this is fascinating. If a mother or father, this is a question, again, of Boniface. If a mother or father gives a child during its early years to a monastery to be brought up in monastic discipline, is it lawful for that child, after reaching the age of puberty, to leave the cloister and enter into marriage? How does the Pope respond? He says, "This we strictly forbid, for it is an impious thing to allow children who have been offered to God by their parents to follow their baser instincts for pleasure." There's a lot more fascinating reading in that letter. We do not have time today, but at a future time, we may even return to St. Boniface. Who knows?
Thank you very much, Joan, and we'll see you next week.
Indeed.
You've been listening to Joan Lewis. To find out more about Joan or to ask her a question, please visit our website.
You have been listening to Jill Bevilacqua, Sean Patrick Lovett, Joan Lewis, and to me, Sister Janet Ferns. You can hear us all again at the same time next week or by going online to the main Vatican Radio website at vaticanradio.org. Click on English and there we are. Until we meet again, may God bless you.